Okay, thanks. So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is September 2nd, 2015. And I want to explore with you the intersection of compassion and equanimity. And I'm focused on that a lot these days. My dad's 96, getting older, he's had some hospitalizations. He's out right now recovering, but there's still some issues there. And like probably many of you, my wife and I have kids, and we worry about them, we care about them, but often there's not much we can do. Or we see things in the news, or we're aware of things close at home or far away. Our heart's moved, and yet we're helpless sometimes to do anything. So how do we balance, how do we bring together the wisdom and practice of compassion with the wisdom and practice of equanimity? So I want to enter into the topic with a story I heard from a teacher of mine, Kamala Masters, who lives in Hawaii. And she tells the story of being in India with many would consider a modern saint, Munindra, who was her teacher, someone she loved dearly. And she was with him and a couple of other people touring around India in various ways. And one of the stories she tells is being in a city, I believe, Benares, in northern India. And she got to go out on the River Ganges really early in the morning. So she and her beloved teacher and her friends were in this little rowboat early in the morning as the dawn, as the sun rose. And the way she tells the story is that on the one side of the river, as the light hit the ancient towers of the city and turning beautiful colors of pink and rose and salmon, she was just overwhelmed with the beauty and the amazingness of the sight. And on the other side of the Ganges were the funeral pyres and the smell of flesh burning and the wailings and the cryings of people who are bringing their family to their loved ones, the bodies of their loved ones, to the funeral pyres to be burned up and turned to ash. And she described compassion and equanimity as having a heart that's big enough and open enough to include both the beauty on the one side of the river and the sorrow and the loss on the other side of the river. A heart that's big enough to include both, with a mind that's steady enough and stable enough also to include both without being disturbed in its core. That's no small accomplishment, is it? And I want to talk with you a bit about what might be involved in that and see what you think. And a way into this could be to bring to mind someone in your life or perhaps a group of people that you care a lot about, and also there's something that's disturbed in the process. You're upset about it. I think about times my wife and I, you know, care a lot about our kids, and they just won't take our advice and they won't do it the right way, and your efforts to help just mess it up more. What do you do? You know? Or be aware of situations where perhaps there is suffering that you turn away from because it's so disturbing to you. It's so distressing, including perhaps related feelings of helplessness. It's so disturbing that your compassion is dialed down, constricted, because you don't have enough equanimity. So making it real, this topic territory can get kind of abstracted. It helps to really bring it down to something concrete, an area that you're really grappling with. Maybe like me, you have a parent or a loved one who's, you know, kind of in the end game of life. There's only one end to this tunnel that they're in right now. And, you know, how you feel about that. So to introduce this, I want to kind of first talk a bit about compassion. You know, if we are compassionate. It's interesting, the research on compassion is that to be truly compassionate, the root of the word you probably know, compatio, to suffer with, to feel with. I've been on the receiving end of a kind of generic compassion sometimes. Oh, I wish you didn't suffer. But there's no empathy behind it. It's like the other person couldn't be bothered to actually be moved in some way, to resonate sympathetically with my own pain. True compassion resonates sympathetically with the pain of the other. There is some quality. It's bittersweet. There is some quality of their suffering. We feel it. It pierces us. We have to be big enough and equanimous enough to allow ourselves to be pierced by the reality. You look in the eye of that person. Maybe it's a person who's frightened themselves in a hospital about those they love. I've spent a lot of time in hospitals lately. You see a lot of people there who are dealing with really tough situations. Do you let yourself be pierced by that? Or if you're just walking down the street, you see someone walking toward you, and you can feel that they're burdened by their life, or they're not that happy, or they're worried about something, or they're working really hard, and you can feel it. Can you let yourself be pierced enough by it, while at the same time, with compassion, not overwhelmed by it, not flooded by it? So what predominates in the mind of compassion is the wish that suffering not be there. Certainly the wish, with a warm-hearted, sympathetic concern, often along with the desire to help. That's what's prominent in the mind of compassion, along with, though, that bitterness, that pain, that empathic receptivity that allows oneself to be pierced by the suffering of the other person. So both are present. Hopefully to sustain compassion, the wish to help, the wish that suffering be relieved, the warm-heartedness is predominant. But there's also that sense of their pain. So how do we tolerate that pain? There's a term in psychology, distress tolerance. Can we tolerate our own distress and the distress in us that's activated sympathetically, resonantly, by the distress of the other person? You know, in Buddhism, there's this wonderful metaphor of the first and the second dart. You know, the first dart is unavoidable discomfort, from subtle to gross, physical and mental, as well as interpersonal. There is an inherent, I think, for us as social beings, social mammals, there's an inherent first dart of heaviness or weightiness or sadness or outrage at injustice, anger, fieriness sometimes. There's an inevitable first dart a lot if we're truly compassionate. Something has landed, right? Who would want to be so peaceful, so equanimous, that they're not distressed or disturbed by the suffering of other people in terms of this wholesome, unavoidable first dart, right? So there is that first dart. But what equanimity is about, as the Buddha teaches, is tolerating the unpleasantness of that first dart, including other, as well as other reactions that arise inside ourselves, such as a desire to help that is then helpless and frustrated about helplessness. To tolerate the presence of that first dart, the unpleasantness, without tipping into craving. It's a fundamental moment of the inner shock absorber of equanimity. We're with the unpleasantness, but it doesn't drag us into the second darts that we throw ourselves in terms of our reactions to things. Calm is not having a reaction. Equanimity is not reacting to our reactions. The reactions may be there. They may arise, and they may trigger a cascade of reactions. But with equanimity, it's held in a larger space of that is undisturbed in our core. There's a saying from an African-American teacher in Los Angeles. I'm blanking on his name. He describes equanimity as looking at the world with quiet eyes. We see the world. Our eyes are open. but our eyes themselves are quiet. What they hold may be noisy and dramatic, but the eyes themselves have a quiet to them. Right? Or a traditional saying in Buddhism is that equanimity is walking evenly over uneven ground. There's a metaphor from Shantideva, the Tibetan monk, I think around the 6th century of the Common Era. And he says that the world is covered with, is full of thorns and brambles and sharp stones. And what are we going to do about it? Well, we could cover the world with leather, or we could put on a pair of shoes. That's equanimity as well. The world is what it is. Our equanimity is not about giving up, changing the world for the better. But meanwhile, can we walk, you know, with shoes on the world and not be upset and anguished by the world that we see? So if you think about it, you can hear already the way that equanimity and compassion support each other. It's interesting, you may know that in Buddhism there's this idea of the four immeasurables or the four abidings of exalted beings, which are of course available for us, compassion, kindness, happiness at the good fortune and joy of others, and equanimity. And it's said that of the four dwelling places of awakened mind available to us in everyday life, of those four, equanimity is the foundation because it enables the others. So how do equanimity and compassion work together? And I invite you to look at a relationship that might be troubled or look at what might serve you to open your heart one f-stop wider, in terms of cameras, you know, one step wider, wider and wider, you know. So on the one hand, without compassion, equanimity can drift into indifference, apathy, the near enemy, so-called, of true equanimity. Compassion warms up equanimity. Compassion also has a teaching in it, because it's interesting, as we are compassionate, that naturally draws us out. Kind of it pulls us out of ourselves. We take things less personally. There's less of a attachment to and a fixation on or identification even with the perspectives arising locally in the mind-body process. We get less caught up in me, myself, and I. And also with compassion, as we're drawn out into the world, we see the larger webs, we see the bigger pictures, we see how many things are caused by many other things interdependently, which takes us into the view of equanimity, which recognizes how so many things intertwine, they're caused by so many causes, so many things upstream, known and unknown. They're made up of so many parts, and they're continually changing. Compassion, in a funny kind of way, can draw us into that sort of wisdom on the one hand, right? And on the other hand, equanimity helps us, as I've said, tolerate our compassion so we're not so flooded by what's there. And you might ask yourself in your own life, are you more of an equanimity type or a compassion type, right? And therefore, what might be useful to you to develop on the other side? You know, there are people we may know who are very passionate about the suffering of others, but they're so disturbed by their care and concern that they're maybe not so effective, actually. And then there are other people, maybe, who, you know, could take that big picture view, but they're so... They like that big picture view because it helps them stay kind of calm and remote and detached. But from the 30,000 foot view, they don't notice all the suffering, you know, down here at sea level. So you might think about that. So whichever way it is for yourself, you know, what might be your own balance there. And one other thing about equanimity and compassion is that if we get so upset by what we witness, we get burned out. There's a real interest in research on caregiver fatigue, caregiver burnout, compassion fatigue, and so forth. And if you think about people, sometimes people ask me as a therapist, right, how do you do it, right? Don't you get upset by the people? I say, well, I get upset, but I recognize it's their life, not mine. It's not that I'm dismissive, but I know it's their life, not mine. And I know that they're in my office due to all kinds of reasons. I know there are a lot of limits in what I can do to help. I'm at peace with those limits. I have a good friend who is very involved in the absolute upper limit of elite medicine for children at Harvard and the intensive care unit there. And he ran the intensive care unit for children at, I'm blanking on the name, the hospital in Boston, this is Boston Children's Hospital. So you just imagine the intensity of the stakes. These are kids, half the kids that go into that ICU do not come out alive. And these are the sickest kids in the world. It's not uncommon for $1 million to be spent on each child's care over the duration there. It's really intense. It's the highest level, super elite. And my friend was running it, which was pretty cool, my first rock climbing partner. And I asked him one time after he gave me the tour, I said to him, wow, Bob, it must be a great comfort to you, because I know how much he cares. He has a huge heart. It must be a great comfort to you to be able to be in this environment where everybody's like world class, you know? The janitors are world class janitors, you know? Trust me, they clean those floors in a world class way. And he looked at me like I didn't get it, because I didn't get it, and he just shrugged. He said, Rick, honestly, I think what we do here is affect maybe 10% of the outcome. The rest of it is just out of our hands. Wow. You know, our job is to do the best we can with that 10% while being at peace with the 90%. What they bring when they walk in the door, the mysteries we don't know about yet, other factors, who knows? The divine, perhaps, altogether, you know, is a factor. Who knows? But, you know, the rest of us out of our hands. So that's a way for him to have the kind of equanimity that lets him go to work every day in the intensity of that environment, and to still have the capacity to cry freshly with the parents of some kid who's in a terrible situation, you know, 30 years into his career. So I want to suggest a few practices, a few practical things you might do to strengthen that intersection, that intertwining, right, of equanimity and compassion, and then see what you think here. So one practice is to deliberately, at will, generate compassion and kindness, which tend to blur together, the wish that a being not suffer, the wish that a being be happy, compassion and kindness. They tend to swirl together, and it's okay. To wish well, to send good wishes to strangers, people you don't know. It's really interesting. There might be people in this room you don't know. I think of it as kind of like hit and run compassion for me. You know, or I think it was like compassion bombs. I'm walking down the street. There's someone I don't know. I kind of get a kick out of picking people that are as unlike me as possible sometimes. And to just really to feel them, not presumptuously, not trying to do mind reading, but to feel that person, to let the gaze stay on that person's face for a few seconds to kind of register them as a being, some sense of them, wishing them well while knowing, because they're passing you on the street, there's nothing you can do, in any ordinary material sense at least, to relieve their suffering or to increase their happiness. Right there is an interesting combination of compassion and equanimity, limits of my capacity to help. That's a very neat practice, to have compassion and kindness for the neutral person, so-called, in terms of the different categories of people we might have compassion and kindness for. A second suggested practice is to deliberately go back and forth in your own mind between what does compassion feel like? Okay, I feel for you, I wish you well. Got it. What does equanimity feel like? Balance. The unpleasant may be there in my mind, but it's held in a vast space that's even keeled and all right. And then go back to compassion, back to equanimity, back and forth, more and more rapidly until both are present in your mind. That's a thing to do just in general, and you could also just do it for a few minutes or longer if you like when you're meditating. Okay? Then they're both present. So it's kind of a neat practice. A third thing is to really acknowledge and feel and own all that you are already doing to relieve suffering. You know, we're sometimes just overwhelmed by the sorrows of the world, challenges, famine, war. I was bouncing around and I found this website that's like the world population meter, and it's sort of very legit. And so you're seeing the current estimate of the world's population, and they have this thing that's also tracking new births, okay? Per, like in real time, right now. And then also, like over the last day, week, month, year, right? Those meters are running more slowly. So there you are, you're just watching births, like, and you just imagine all these kids born around the world, right? In real time, right? The children of 7.3-ish billion humans. And then your eye moves further down the page, where you start seeing deaths. Their best estimate on the rate of deaths. It's a little slower because the population of the planet is still rising, more births than deaths. But right there too, you just go, oh my God. Like one per second or more, you know, so many people around the world dying. Literally, we've been sitting here. How many people have died? Many of whom not in happy, peaceful, pain-free circumstances while we've been sitting here tonight. Like, wow. You know, so it can bring up feelings of helplessness, futility, turning away, revisiting the motto of the Hell's Angels, live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse, you know? Like you turn away, right? Yeah. I've never been in a Hell's Angel, but that's what Hunter Thompson said. But anyway, and so my point is, you know, it really helps when you're facing that to appreciate and really own. We're often the last to know the fullness of the good we do for others. To really own for yourself, to really let it in. All the little things, the work of service, a lot of people are in a helping profession of one kind or another, raising family, little acts of kindness, just being someone who's been practicing and is a little calmer, a little more loving, a little more peaceful, a little more willing to see the bigger picture, a little more patient in groups of various kinds, including people who don't even know each other in theaters, like how people move out of a theater. Just the way a person is can really affect others. Really owning some, you know, as much as you can and acknowledging so many forms of relieving of service, so many good intentions, so many acts of thought and word and body over the course of your life and currently. And owning that and claiming that can help you be more comfortable with and equanimous about the reality of the limits of your influence in this complicated, enormous, interconnected world we have. Okay. Then I have my fourth and last suggestion. It's a little kind of more subtle. It's to recognize that the experience of compassion the feelings of compassion and related feelings of heaviness or upset or anger or despair, whatever that might be. That whole flow of experience is transient, it's changing, it's made up of many parts. It is, in the technical sense, empty. It's insubstantial. And craving that arises related to it. Sometimes there's craving that arises around compassion, a drivenness to help, a wanting to give advice, a sense of being agitated and wanting to fix things, wanting things to change. Those are subtle forms of craving. Subtle. They're maybe well-intended. You know, what's the thing, though? The road to hell is paved with good intentions. Or as my wife says, that the road to health is paved with good intestines. But that's another thing, totally off topic. Finishing up my point here. So my point about that, it's to really observe the phenomenology, in effect, of the experience itself. Not getting airy-fairy or metaphysical about it, just observing directly that compassion itself, concern, disturbance, weightiness. My dad's in a real pickle, and there's a lot of weightiness in me. I'm not upset, but I'm affected, right? We're affected. But that experience of being affected is itself phenomenologically empty, if you look closely at it. And as the Buddha taught very, very acutely, as we kind of tease apart the threads, the elements of experience, because it's empty, there's no point in essentializing any part of it, thingifying, reifying any part of it into an object that we can grab onto, hold, and cling to, and have craving in reference to. So it means bringing insight, vipassana, insight, into the experience of compassion itself, and letting compassion go moment by moment by moment, even as it also arises in the next moment. And if that kind of practice is real for you, it can be really quite powerful. And of course, it's also a nice training in relating to experience with non-attachment, letting it flow. Letting it flow and letting it go. Even as we open to the next wave of warm-heartedness that arises. And then the last thing I would say, my fifth and final suggestion, is to watch eye making and mind making. To watch and watch cautiously. In other words, watch in the sense of disengaging from taking things so personally, getting caught up in me. As soon as we start getting caught up in me, the compassion starts getting complicated and it's harder to sustain. We start getting more disturbed around it. You know, it's the opposite of equanimity. You know, if we get identified with, you know, even these little micro-heroic fantasies, I'm going to be the guy who figures this out finally. You know, now you're in trouble. Or I should say more honestly, now I am in trouble as soon as I go there. Oh, I'll write a book that will just solve that problem forever. No, you know, as soon as you go there, bingo, you know, you've lost that. Equanimity goes down, and as equanimity goes down, as I-making and my-making goes up, me-making goes up, equanimity goes down, it's harder and harder to sustain real, true compassion. Because the real movement of compassion is a release of selflessness. So as selfing increases, the selflessness that undergirds compassion diminishes. And it's harder and harder to sustain. Okay. All right. Compassion, equanimity. Your own reflections, comments, stories. Great, please.
As you're talking, I work in a psychiatric hospital and with a lot of very poor people, and I've noticed my own experience of feeling helpless and why am I even bothering and leaning toward burnout, and then balancing that the way you're discussing. And how as I get older and practice more, how I allow myself to really connect and cry with patients and how much that affects them, even though I can't really refer them to the appropriate services. And that's been really valuable for me. I'm thinking of an experience today when I was crying with a woman, and I thought, wow, even 10 years ago, I would have felt so unprofessional doing this. And then I had an experience today, which is so bizarre that it's hardly...
By the way, are you all able to hear her? It's really good. Make sure you're speaking loud enough, because it's wonderful.
I work in a psychiatric hospital, and I had a very strange experience today that is bugging me, that was testing my own compassion and equanimity, which is I have a patient who is psychotic, and I know her from repeat hospitalizations, and she came in saying that now she's really distraught because her daughter's dying of cancer. And, you know, sitting with her and just feeling this, and I found out today that that's a delusion. And her daughter is just so sick of people calling, and I thought, wow, this really changes, and she's completely believes it.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is really challenging my ability to sit with her. And I was getting kind of absorbed in my reaction, sitting with her, like, really, you know, what that meant about the human experience, you know, what's real, what's not, what deserves my compassion, what doesn't. And I've been really sitting with that, and, you know, I'll see her tomorrow, and, you know, I noticed myself trying to get away from her at some point. You know, she didn't have my heart the way that she had before, and I'm troubled by that, and it's really, it's just an interesting twist. You know, I have this fabulous profession that I'm never bored at, but it tests me in all these unexpected ways. Just to put that out there as kind of a, you know, an unusual experience.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. And it is interesting, briefly on my little comment about it, which is that research shows that it tends to be harder to, it's easy to give compassion for those who are innocent, but to have compassion for those who we judge as morally culpable in their own pickle, their own suffering, their own predicament, that's often a lot harder. So if we disapprove of a certain person or class of people, it's harder to have compassion for them. And, you know, to generalize, but I think it's probably pretty relevant, if you think about the epidemic of HIV/AIDS early on, you know, there were a lot of issues for people who had disapproval around, you know, homosexuality, et cetera, or IV drug use or other sorts of things. And it was hard to bring compassion to that suffering, but the suffering was very, very real, as an example of that. So one of the interesting things in your own practice, and I've been exploring it myself, is to separate my compassion from my view. There's a place for view, okay? We might have view, and including, you know, I'm watching you pound your foot with a hammer while asking me to help you with the pain in your foot, right? I get that part, but still, it really hurts, and to pull those apart. So even if, let's say, one of the causes of a person's misery is a delusion they have, or ways they're acting with others that then cause those other people to treat them, let's say, badly, but to tease that apart and just say, to have just pure compassion for what is there, you know? That's a beautiful practice, and there's also then a freedom around it, and a simplicity, because who knows all the causes. You know, we might judge these people are worthy of our compassion, these people are not so worthy. What do we actually fully know? But we do know there is suffering, right? And our heart can be moved by it. Yeah. And it's also freeing, because then if we're having to make choices, you deserve compassion, you don't, you know, up, down, like, what a burden. And so much, as you put it, I making and my making right there. Maybe one last comment or story, yeah. Oh, great, please.
Just a reflection on, you know, the challenge I hear. I live in Gerstle Park near the open space area, and there's quite a problem with homeless people living there, as there is a problem with homeless people downtown. Most of them are, I would say, either substance abuse and or mentally ill. And what I hear in a lot of the discussions about what to do with them is not much compassion, you know, a lot of anger. And some of the anger is justified, but almost every one of them is sick. So,
right. Thank you. Yeah.
It's a very real issue in our community.
Yeah. So just to restate it also so everyone could hear it, we have groups of people, let's say homeless people in San Rafael, many of whom are mentally ill and or substance abusing, or whatever else led that person to be there that day. It's hard to imagine that someone, you know, resolved when they were 7 years old, you know what I want to be when I grow up? Living under a bridge. You know, you know what I mean, right? So, and then, and yet the response often to it as, you know, as a public safety issue sometimes or other sorts of issues, is to have an anger or righteousness and so forth. And that's where I think it's such a great example, maybe finishing on this one, where equanimity is really helpful. So on the one hand, we can see larger causes and factors. You know, the reality that sometimes, for example, as cities become more hospitable to the homeless, more homeless people come. And then it creates other larger issues. Or we might see ways in which people have been among the 10,000 causes of that situation. Some of those causes have their name written all over them, amongst many other causes. We can see that while at the same time letting our hearts be really moved by that other person, that other being, right? And where this shows up sometimes for me is around parenting, where on the one hand, you can have compassion for your kid, but you also recognize, let's say, that this kid got that, I'm just thinking of a silly little example, my own kids, maybe when they were younger, our kid, which shall be nameless, but anyway, there are only two of them, you know, gets a bad grade in middle school, and he, I admit it. The bottom line, he got the bad grade because he didn't study ever. He was totally doing video games. And so you can have compassion for the kid being upset, let's say, as he was, like, ooh, bad grade, ooh, wince, feeling bad. While at the same time recognizing that, well, guess what? There is some justice that's happening here. There is a natural consequence, and it's okay. So sometimes our compassion and our equanimity, and I gestured to you, I don't mean this about homeless people. I'm actually thinking of a different example. You know, Stephen Gaskin, who had this great collection of talks, Monday Night Class, back in the hippie days, he described karma as hitting golf balls in a shower. And sometimes our compassion leads us to intervene between the person's action and the golf ball. That's the natural consequence that's coming back. Whereas equanimity and the wisdom of equanimity would have us step back a little bit and let that ball still land while we have compassion for that person and not glee that justice is finally served. Right? So that might be a way to think about that. And the last thing I'll just say is a little seed at the end is this applies to ourselves as well. To have compassion for ourselves, but also the kind of balanced view that recognizes the causes of some of the pickles maybe we find ourselves in. Okay, lots of good stuff. How about we just sit for a minute and enjoy the background music coming from upstairs? Just for a minute, letting it all sink in. it really helps to bring compassion and equanimity down into the body. The body of compassion, the body of equanimity, your body of equanimity with compassion, your body of compassion with equanimity, what that's like. Sinking in and stabilizing in you and as you. Thank you. Take good care.